From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. On this week's podcast, it's been a hard year for Moore, Oklahoma, devastated by a tornado, but the mayor is rallying the city.
You kind of have to be the cheerleader, I guess you might say, for the city. Fortunately, the people here are very resilient.
Plus, people who changed the world and left us in 2013. From a guy who pioneered fracking to the scientist who figured out how genes work.
This was one of the most important discoveries in the history of biology.
We'll also take you back to the days when hijackers became pop culture heroes.
They weren't out to cause mass death and destruction. They were in it to negotiate. So it was really a more transactional experience than a kind of terrorist experience.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West.
By the friendly skies of United.
Let us take you back now to a different era in air travel. The 1960s, when traveling the skies meant luxury. You could light up a cigarette on board or enjoy a five-star meal.
It's like lobster Newburgh, filet mignon with Bordelaise sauce, prepared as you like it.
In coach, we'll show you our pub. Yes, the pub is back, and it's more fun than ever.
This airplane is just like a limousine. Feel like a millionaire, sitting back all relaxed and saying, drive on.
Come fly with me, let's float down to Peru.
And then there was the ease of it all. Like the boarding process, which wasn't any harder than getting on a bus.
You'd be dropped off at the curb, walk through the whole terminal.
That's Brendan Kerner, author of the book, The Skies Belong to Us.
Onto the tarmac, to the top of the boarding stairs, and sometimes onto the plane without a ticket, without showing anyone your ID, without having your body or your luggage searched at all.
Imagine that, flying before all those TSA lines, all the hassle. It was a different time.
I'll be holding you so...
But there were consequences.
This is the news in detail on the hour from the WOR newsroom. Two airline hijackings tonight in the United States, still in progress. In Los Angeles, a Western Airlines plane set down...
Skyjackings. When Congress created the Federal Aviation Agency in 1958, Brendan Kerner says they didn't even bother to make hijacking a crime. The prospect was just too absurd. But again and again, people seeking money or fame or passage to Havana would carry a gun or a bomb or a bluff on board a plane and take it hostage. Amid the Vietnam War, cities erupting in riots and political assassinations, Kerner says the U.S. was also facing a skyjacking epidemic.
By the end of the 60s, you were having 30, 40 hijackings a year.
The spectacular hijacking that I'd always heard about from that period was D.B. Cooper. He was the guy that parachuted out of a plane with a couple $100,000 in cash, and somebody wrote a song about him. And there was an episode of In Search Of, the Leonard Nimoy documentary show, all about him. But he wasn't even close to being the most spectacular of these characters, it turns out.
Yeah, there's a couple of great ones I talk about in the book. The first one that pops to mind is Rafael Minichiello, who was an Italian-American Marine who had a pay dispute with the Marines and decided to solve his problem by hijacking a plane from Los Angeles to his native Italy, where he was greeted as a folk hero and actually ended up signing a contract to start a spaghetti western after serving just 18 months in prison there.
Very handsome man, too.
Yes, a sex symbol as well. In fact, Italian teenagers would talk about how much they wanted to marry him and how more beautiful he was than most matinee idols in that country.
Give a sense of the times as well, because it didn't seem people were all that scared. It was almost like a joke.
That's really fascinating me. In doing the research and seeing the kind of flippant attitude people had about hijackings, a lot of people saw them as an adventure. And I think part of that goes into the way these hijackers operated. They weren't out to cause mass death and destruction. They were in it to negotiate. And that made sense for the airlines to comply with them. They said, well, let's have them come up to the cockpit as quickly and quietly as possible and get to know what they want. So it was really a more transactional experience than a kind of terrorist experience.
You know, it was wild that what you describe is how the airlines are almost in complete conflict with law enforcement, with FBI, about the approach to hijackings.
Yeah, the biggest thing for the airlines was the bottom line. They really feared that if there was any kind of death or mayhem that resulted from a hijacking, they'd lose a lot of business. People would be afraid to fly. So they thought the safest thing they could do is given to the hijacker. You'll get the plane back. If the hijacker asks for a ransom, you usually get the ransom back as well, because most of these hijackers weren't very good criminals. So they figured it was much, much better financial play to have this policy of total compliance than get gun-toting federal agents involved.
Your book follows the story in detail of one pair of hijackers in particular, who seem to really sum up a lot of what seems to be the essence of these hijacking stories. Could you talk about, tell the story of Roger Holder and Kathy Kirkow?
So Roger Holder was a 22-year-old Vietnam vet. He'd served four tours in Vietnam. And during his third tour, he was arrested for smoking a joint on a street in Saigon and sentenced to the stockade. And he felt this was very unjust based on his record of service. Came into conflict with a commanding officer, was sent back to the U.S. and went AWOL and was living in San Diego. And he meets Kathy Kirkow, this 20-year-old woman from a small town in Oregon, Coos Bay, Oregon, working in a massage parlor in San Diego. And it turns out that actually their paths had crossed as children. Roger Holder's family had briefly lived in Coos Bay. And so Roger Holder, who was a big fan of astrology, thought that this was kismet and that they were meant to do something amazing together. And that amazing thing was hijack a plane.
It's a wild tale. We can't really get into all the details of it, but they both make their way to France. He ends up coming back to America, to a very different America. But Kathy Kirkow just sort of vanished.
Yeah, that's the real mystery of the book, is what happened to Kathy Kirkow. She certainly seems to have vanished around 1978. And what we do know is that she was able to obtain some very convincing false documents that would have helped her perhaps even get citizenship with the aid of a French associate. So I'd like to think that she's there right now.
So when was it that law enforcement and the airlines were able to finally see eye to eye on how to tackle the problem?
There was a real milestone event in November 1972, the hijacking of Southern Airways Flight 49. This was a commuter flight in Alabama, and three fugitives from justice hijacked it and demanded $10 million. And they said that if they didn't get that amount of money, they would crash the plane into a nuclear reactor in Tennessee. And that was the real moment when the airlines realized that planes could be used as weapons of mass destruction, and that the liabilities involved in this policy of total compliance and lax security were no longer tenable.
That the equation could not just be about trading a plane or hostages for something. It could be about, well, what we saw at 9/11.
Yeah, once you had it in the mix that you turned Tennessee into a nuclear wasteland, they didn't want to be involved in that anymore. And literally 6 weeks after that hijacking, you had the debut of universal physical screening that we all know and love now.
What's amazing as well is that when you're writing about the earlier days in this book, the airlines float out the possibility of, like, what could we do? Could we screen everybody? That would take forever. Nobody would ever put up with that. That would just mean chaos. And then they did it. And what happened?
Yeah, actually, passengers seem to enjoy not being hijacked. The first year that they had this universal screening, there were actually no hijackings that year after they instituted it. And passenger numbers actually went up about 15%. So people liked the idea. At that point, things had gotten so crazy, they liked the idea of not having their plane commandeered by a person with a bomb.
That's Brendan Koerner. His book is The Skies Belong to Us, Love and Terror in the Golden Age of Hijacking. Brendan, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
We're going to check in now with the city of Moore, Oklahoma. Back in May, it was devastated by a mile-wide F5 tornado with winds in excess of 200 miles per hour. The day after the storm, Mayor Glenn Lewis told Morning Edition that rescue crews were still searching for survivors.
We're still looking for, hopefully that one extra person that we missed that we're going to find. We're very optimistic about that. We did have quite a bit of loss of life.
In all, 24 people died, including seven children at an elementary school. Now, 7 months later, Mayor Lewis says the rebuilding effort is picking up steam.
The recovery is going quite well right now. If you'd asked me a couple months ago, I would have said it's going pretty slow, but I just got the permit numbers and how we're doing right now. We have 421 storm damage remodels in the process, so not bad. Over three-fourths of the houses are being rebuilt as we speak.
One of the awful images that stuck in a lot of people's minds was the school that was just wiped out. How's the rebuilding gone?
Well, actually, the rebuilding over there is going quite well. They have to, or they're going to have the school built by the next school session, and it has a storm room in it. So everybody's quite happy about that. We're in the process. The city is actually building 4 brand new elementary schools. We're growing that fast. And all 4 of them are going to have storm shelters before they're open.
And I understand you also run your own jewelry store full time.
I do.
So it sounds like a kind of a close-knit community. I imagine a lot of the first responders were people you know.
Well, you know, after a tornado like that and more, we are basically all first responders. So we help as much as we can. You know, we try to recover all the losses that we can, especially in people. You know, we look for people for the first 82 hours. So that's what we do. Then we go to cleaning it up.
Now, of course, this wasn't the first tornado to hit your city. Back in 1999, another F5 tornado with record-breaking winds ripped through the town. You were mayor then as well. I wonder if you could talk about what it's like to lead a city now through 2 disasters like this.
You know, we're the only city in the United States that's ever had 2 F5 tornadoes.
Wow.
That's kind of crazy, isn't it?
It's hard for me to get my head around that, to be honest with you.
Well, actually, I've had 6 tornadoes during my term as mayor. I've been mayor for 20 years. You kind of have to be, you know, the cheerleader, I guess you might say, for the city. And it's a continual process, you know, that we've had to do, and it's a struggle. But fortunately, the people here are very resilient. But at the same time, you know, you still have to deal with the loss of life, and that's the hardest part.
Glenn Lewis is the mayor of Moore, Oklahoma, a city recovering from an F5 tornado that touched down in May. Mayor Lewis, thank you, and have a great new year.
Thanks, appreciate it. You too.
Now another check-in on a story we brought you back in April. We met Thomas Young, an Iraq War veteran whose spinal injury left him paralyzed below the waist. Further medical complications made him a quadriplegic. This is how KCUR's Frank Morris told the story.
The documentary Body of War follows Young's activism and physical struggles. In this scene, his mom, Kathy Smith, tries to attach a urine catheter in the back of a car.
Hey, Mom. We generally tend to watch what goes on up there.
I'm trying to move it so it doesn't just go everywhere.
Good plan.
I'm glad that it came out and people saw the reality of war.
Young now spends most of his time here, lying flat on his back, smoking in his dimly lit bedroom in Kansas City.
But now I can't even watch it because it serves as a reminder of what I used to be able to do.
So, facing that grim circumstance, Thomas Young chose to give up. He said he would refuse medication and his feeding tube until he died. That's how our story ended in April. But we've since learned that somewhere along the way, Thomas Young had a change of heart. He's now living in Portland, Oregon, and that's where we reached him.
Well, I just came to the conclusion that I wanted to spend more time with my wife, and I decided that I really don't have the chutzpah to go ahead and do away with myself.
If you're having trouble understanding him, he said he didn't have the chutzpah to do away with himself, and he wanted some more time with his wife, Claudia Cuellar.
She has been an amazing wife. Everything a man could ask for in a partner, I have found in a 5'2.5" Colombian woman that is just a spitfire and incredible.
Even though I'm technically his caregiver, he's really the one that's carried me. You know, he's been so, as a partner, so patient with me. You know, I'm kind of a little bit on the crazy side. And so he's just given me the space to be myself. So we definitely feel like it's a joint partnership, like we're here to support each other as human beings.
And what are your feelings looking forward to as we're about to start a new year?
Well, we're excited to be in Portland, and we're looking forward. The Portland Art Museum is doing a big New Year's event. We're going to the party, and we're really excited about dressing up and just rolling over one block to the museum and, you know, having a good time and looking forward to, you know, whatever time we can be together.
And after all we've heard about what you guys have been through, it's so nice to think about the two of you going to a party.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe you should wear like a tuxedo t-shirt and like velour blazer with a fedora. So we're going to go to the haberdasher later, and then I'm trying to decide my outfit.
Nice.
Not from the family, she just sounds like it.
Thomas, but before I let you go, is there anything else that you would like to say to all of us who have been following you and your story?
I would say I'm hanging in there, and if you're in life and you start to think things are a little too rough to handle, just think of me and what I go through, and you realize that, hey, I don't have so bad.
Thomas and Claudia, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Best of luck to both of you in 2014. Thank you.
Bye. Okay. Bye.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Since you're sure to be hearing obituaries and tributes to big names like Lou Reed or James Gandolfini, before turning the page on 2013, we wanted to tell you about people you may not have heard of, and maybe some unknown stories about those you already knew. First, three visionary scientists passed away this year. Because of their work, researchers today developed a new vaccine to save infants from respiratory disease and are figuring out how to use your own immune system to attack cancer. NPR's Rebecca Hersher has this appreciation.
In the summer of 1940, a young medical student left his home in occupied France to join the fight against Germany. His name was François Jacob, and he wanted to be a surgeon. But first, he wanted to fight. Jacob never became a surgeon. In August 1944, he was defending Normandy when a bomb blast nearly killed him. He described his injuries many years later. My entire right side was filled with grenade fragments, he said. It was a dreadful time. His hands were no longer steady enough for surgery. So in 1950, he joined a small group of scientists in Paris. The laboratory was in an attic. It was cramped and the equipment was old. But there in that attic, looking at bacteria, Jacob made one of the greatest discoveries in the history of biology. He figured out how genes work. Carl Zimmer is a science writer.
This was one of the most important discoveries in the history of biology. All your cells in your body have the same DNA in them, and yet they're very different. So a neuron in your brain is using a certain set of genes in order to let you think. A cell in your stomach is using a different set of genes to let you eat. If you can't turn your genes on and off, you're dead.
Jacob figured all of that out, and for his discovery, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1965. With it came fame and fortune. Meanwhile, in England, another young scientist was also interested in how genes worked. Frederick Sanger was 2 years older than François Jacob. When war came to England, he didn't fight. He was a pacifist, a Quaker. So he stayed at Cambridge University and worked on his chemistry degree. And Sanger was a smart guy. By 1958, he had his own Nobel Prize for coming up with a way to map out the building blocks of proteins. But he wasn't content, says Carl Zimmer.
He said, okay, well, figured out that problem. Let's think about genes. So genes are made of their own building blocks. And the problem is they're a lot more complicated because genes can be thousands and thousands of building blocks long.
Sanger was notoriously solitary. He worked long hours building a machine that would sequence DNA.
He actually sequenced the first genome. He sequenced the genome of a virus. It was a colossal amount of work. This took him years and years and years.
But it paid off. In 1980, Sanger won a second Nobel Prize. Only three other people have ever done that. Sanger's discoveries eventually led to the sequencing of the first human genome. And at the same time in America, there was a young doctor named David Hubel. He wasn't interested in genes or proteins. He was interested in cells, brain cells. So he invented a tiny electrode, the width of a single hair, and he hooked it up so he could listen to the brain. That's David Hubel's original recording. It sounds kind of like staticky gunfire, but it's actually the sound of nerve cells in the brain. He used his electrode to figure out how vision works.
People thought of the brain as kind of a camera. And so light comes into your eye or smells come into your nose, and your brain just passively receives it all and is just making a picture of the outside world.
Hubel turned that idea on its head. He showed the brain isn't passive at all. It changes and adapts as we experience things. And for that, Hubel won his own Nobel Prize in 1981. David Hubel, Frederick Sanger, and Francois Jacob all died this year. Carl Zimmer says it's worth reflecting on their work.
It's hard to imagine modern medicine without the contributions of these people.
Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
Everyone knows the term serial killer, but probably not the man who coined it. Robert Ressler was the FBI investigator who literally wrote the book on criminology during a career spent researching serial killers and other violent offenders. Ressler died earlier this year. NPR's Becky Sullivan tells us more.
There are people that are pretty good at this, and I would consider myself one of them, certainly.
That's Robert Ressler talking to NPR back in 1997. By then, he had already retired from an FBI career that was both long and influential.
Extremely influential. The word extremely doesn't capture it.
Roy Hazelwood worked with Robert Ressler at the FBI for over 20 years. Before he joined the Bureau, Ressler's time in military and civilian law enforcement had piqued his curiosity about crimes that were tough to understand. Violent, sometimes sexual, always seemingly irrational. So Ressler thought, by figuring out how and why these criminals worked, maybe the next time, police could better figure out who they were looking for. Soon after joining the FBI in 1970, Robert Ressler had the Bureau convinced of the legitimacy of criminal profiling. Hazelwood says that that was far from his only contribution.
He and another man, John Douglas, were the first individuals who actually conducted research on serial killers. In fact, they coined the term serial killers.
That research demanded that Ressler be a thorough and fearless investigator.
He went out face-to-face interviews with the most notorious and successful serial killers at that particular time.
Men like Ted Bundy and Jeffrey Dahmer. And Ressler developed curious relationships with the ones he visited most often. He told a documentary team that during one of his interviews with John Wayne Gacy, the killer gifted him with a colorful self-portrait of himself as a clown.
There was an inscription on the back which would read, Dear Bob Ressler, you cannot hope to enjoy the harvest without first laboring in the fields. Best wishes and good luck. Sincerely, John Wayne Gacy, June 1988. I said, well, thank you very much, John, but just what are you referring to? What harvest are we talking about? What labor are we talking about in the fields and what fields? And he said, well, Mr. Ressler, he said, you're the criminal profiler, you're the FBI, and he said, you figure it out.
Figure what out? That's impossible to know for sure. Gacy was executed in 1994. But Robert Ressler lived much longer, long enough to see that case reopened in 2011. Investigators still hope to name the killer's remaining unidentified victims. Robert Ressler died in May. He was 76 years old. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
Another man who changed the world without attaining celebrity status passed away this year. George Mitchell was a Texas oil and gas man who played a big part in creating America's growing energy independence, so frequently touted by politicians. Mitchell and his company pioneered the now controversial technique known as fracking.
He was the one who proved that you could get gas out of shale.
Wall Street Journal reporter Russell Gold is author of an upcoming book on fracking.
Before the breakthrough well in 1997, the United States was an energy pauper. It was an importer. It had just dregs left of oil and gas. That was the conventional wisdom. You fast forward almost 20 years now, and the United States is awash. There's a glut of gas and an emerging glut of oil.
You know, obviously there are a lot of people who are opposed to fracking, you know, because of concern for the environment, and they might be, you know, prone to think of Mitchell as kind of a villain, but he was really big on the sustainability movement.
He was enormously involved in sustainability. In the early 1970s, he ends up at a retreat where he meets Buckminster Fuller and falls under the sway of Buckminster Fuller. This great
radical, like innovative, technological thinker,
very innovative, forward thinker, kind of created the idea of spaceship Earth. You know, we have this one Earth. How do we preserve it? But interestingly enough, he never takes that into his business. He never invests in any renewable energy. One of his sons calls it the Mitchell paradox, that he could never quite understand why Mitchell was so intellectually interested in sustainability, but never wanted to take that into his corporation and take the same stubborn approach that he did to figuring out how to frack and crack open shale rock to figuring out how to make renewables work better.
That's Wall Street Journal reporter Russell Gold talking about fracking pioneer George Mitchell, who died this year at age 94. We'll stay in Texas for our next character. This time, it's a famous name, a pro football coach, but an underappreciated figure. Maybe that's because his team came close to immortality, but never quite made it.
We're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers.
In the late 1970s, the Houston Oilers were one of the most dominant teams in the NFL. One problem, maybe the best team ever, kept them out of the Super Bowl 2 years in a row, the Pittsburgh Steelers. The Oilers' head coach during that run was Bum Phillips. He died back in October.
I met Bum Phillips in 1977, and I knew him right up until the day he died.
John McClain has covered the NFL from Houston for 37 years. He says Bum Phillips fit the city of Houston like a glove, always strolling the sidelines in his cowboy hat and boots.
Bum Phillips was a country cowboy, never met a stranger, was a great player's coach. He would stop practice, and he would have an ice cream truck come on the field. At training camp, he would have pizza and beer parties.
Phillips stood out from other hard-nosed NFL coaches in that way, and it drew some criticism that he was too soft on his players. In a 2003 interview with NFL Films, Bum Phillips explained in his own folksy way.
I loved my mom, and I knew she loved me, but she whipped me when she needed to, and that's the way I felt about players.
Beyond the football field, Bum Phillips became well known for his colorful turns of phrase. Perhaps the most famous bumism came in 1980, after his Oilers came up one game short of the Super Bowl, again at the hands of the Steelers. When they returned to Houston, defeated, a huge crowd filled the Astrodome to show their support and admiration. Bum Phillips addressed the crowd with this. 1 year ago, we knocked on the door. This year, we beat on the door.
Next year, we're going to kick the son of a in.
Bum Phillips never got that chance. The Oilers lost in the playoffs the next season, and he was fired. He spent 5 fruitless years coaching the New Orleans Saints, then retired to his ranch in 1985.
He might be in the Hall of Fame if it hadn't been for the Steelers, because most people thought the Oilers were the second-best team in football during that era.
That's John McClain of the Houston Chronicle. Bum Phillips died this year at the age of 90. The passing of another sports legend went largely unnoticed this year, a figure you probably know from the movie A League of Their Own.
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying! There's no crying in baseball!
LaVon Pepper Pear Davis made her mark with the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League in the 1940s, a time when girls just didn't play ball.
Customarily, baseball skill is first acquired in childhood. And up to now, most little girls have concentrated on their knitting rather than their hitting. These high steppers were the exceptions.
You had to live down this image of being a girl ball player. That was not the most popular thing to be in our era.
This is Pepper Pear Davis speaking in a documentary made in the late 80s, also called A League of Their Own.
They looked at you kind of funny, you know, why weren't you in the kitchen, and were you really a ball player, and especially you wore a skirt? The image was not that great. This is why.
If you're thinking, man, she does not sound like the type to cry during a ball game, well, she wasn't. Pepper Pear, as she was known at the time, was tough, a hard-playing catcher who really loved the game. That documentary was seen by Penny Marshall, who got the story made into the Hollywood feature. Pear was also a driving force in the effort to win recognition for the league in the Baseball Hall of Fame. And she wrote a memoir reflecting on her time as a professional ball player.
It was one of the greatest experiences of my life. I was doing something I loved. I was with people that were great people. It's the second dearest memory in my heart, and the first one would be my son, my daughter, my grandson. AAGPBL ranks right up there, awful close to it, close enough to be warm.
LaVon Pepper Pear Davis, who died this year at age 88.
To play ball with the members of the All-American League, we come from city.
By the way, this song from the movie was the real league anthem, co-written by Pepper Pear.
Chaperones are not too soft, they're not too tough. Our managers are on the ball. We got a president who really knows his stuff. We're one for all, we're all American.
And we'll wrap up our remembrances with Emmy and Grammy Award-winning singer Edie Gourmet. She died this summer at the age of 84. Gourmet was half of the married singing duo known as Steve and Edie. And as NPR Sonari Glinton tells us, her talent was undeniable. Her style, well, Sonari will tell you.
Edie Gourmet was not cool. Now, don't get me wrong. She often operated adjacent to cool, touring with Frank Sinatra, palling with Sammy Davis Jr. Those guys, cool. Edie Gourmet didn't even try.
Blame it on the bossa nova with its magic spell.
That was Gourmet's first chart-topping hit, Blame It on the Bossa Nova. Edith Gormazano was born in the Bronx in 1928 to an Italian father and a Turkish mother. Both were Sephardic Jews and spoke Ladino, a variant of Old Spanish. Gourmet's fluency in Spanish helped bring her fame in Latin America, beginning with her performances with the group Trios Los Panchos.
Amor, amor, amor.
Gourmet met her husband, Steve Lawrence, on the set of The Tonight Show with Steve Allen in 1953. While virtually inseparable, Gourmet maintained a solo career.
I mean, it's a big, beautiful, rich, deep voice.
Will Friedwald is a jazz critic with the Wall Street Journal, and he's author of the book Jazz Singing.
The voice itself is not as completely unique as, I don't know, Barbara Streisand, and yet, you know, I can always tell Barbara Streisand within 30 milliseconds, but I would much, much, much rather listen to Edie Gourmet. She was a much greater interpreter, had a much more, I think, a more beautiful sound, if a less distinctive sound, and a much more personal approach.
Was I soft or was I tough? Did I give enough?
By the late 60s, rock was cool. Right as Steve and Edie were becoming a part of the show business establishment, that establishment crumbled. But Friedwald says Gourmet's standards never wavered, and few people could sing as loud and with as much emotion.
Oh, the emotional thing was always there. You know, she always could get inside a song and make you feel it, you know, from the inside out. That was, even if it was something as silly as Blame It on the Bossa Nova or something as epically moving as If He Walked Into My Life.
Would I be there when he called? If he walked into my life today?
Classy, sophisticated, funny, attractive, show-stoppingly talented, but not cool. Edie Gourmet was not cool at all.
That I'd run dry off. What would I give if my old know-how...
Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
It's time now for the new and the next. Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. Each week he joins us to talk about what's new and what's next. Welcome back, Carlos.
Arun, good to be with you, and happy holidays to you and all the listeners.
Happy holidays to you, too. So, you know, I love jazz, and you have a piece this week about a teacher who's using jazz to teach democracy. Can you explain that?
So Dr. Wes Watkins grew up in Oakland. There was good music all around him, but he was never a musician himself. Made his way to Stanford and Oxford, ultimately got a PhD in music education. And along the way, Arun, he realized that both the structure and the improv nature of jazz was not dissimilar from democracy, and that, in fact, you needed both.
It's the way that we interact with each other that makes the music good or not and makes the democracy good or not. And it's about this magic balance, I think, that jazz musicians have the ability to balance individual freedom and what's best for the group, which I think is a struggle for any democracy.
And he realized that there was an opportunity to teach junior high school and elementary school students who normally got bored at talk of things like democracy more about it by using principles of jazz. And so he's done that in an incredibly successful way in a number of schools in the Bay Area and particularly in Oakland, and is continuing to grow it.
Yeah, you know, if anybody's ever actually tried to play the music, to actually do that, to integrate and have your own voice, it does make sense when you think about it.
He has the students role play a little bit, or sometimes he will show them professionals performing and kind of weave in those concepts, and ultimately it allows them to understand qualities of dissent, of working together, of allowing the minority sometimes to stand out, and it's been an incredible vehicle for students understanding and getting more excited, honestly, about the issue of democracy.
Finally, you know, a lot of people are going to be planning New Year's Eve parties right about now, and, you know, you either stress out about the food or about the music. At least on the second one of those two, there's some help for that you've been writing about.
So there's this wonderful new site called Mixify that just launched about a year ago. Not surprisingly, like many good party things, it started in Brooklyn. The cool thing about Mixify is that you log on, and there, famous DJs from around the world are allowing live streams of their performances. So they may be in a club in New York, but you could stream from the website their music and even their performance. You could put it onto a screen in your home, in another club. And that way, you not only get to kind of enjoy the party remotely, but you get access to the coolest music. And whether you want it for a full-on party or whether you just want to exercise their music, it's a very cool way to expand the party, if you will, to take the party global.
And I guess these DJs feel comfortable enough that they're not worried about losing people in the clubs.
Not at all. In fact, in a lot of cases, whether you're kind of one of the big-name acts like Crystal Method or if you've heard of the Adventure Club, which is one of the very cool DJ duos out there, in some ways you're kind of expanding your brand. You're getting people who normally wouldn't get access to you because they're not in New York, L.A., London, Ibiza, or other places to get a chance to taste what you're doing. And in some cases around what they're doing is the clubs, a local club, might actually strike a deal with these DJs and agree to have a remote DJ, if you will, and will actually pay them. So for some of these DJs, there's also some commercial upside if this goes well.
Nice. So there could be a holographic DJ coming soon to a small town near you.
Hey, I think all things considered needs a little remote party and, you know, make it a global holiday gathering.
Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. You can explore all the stories we talk about at npr.org/new and next. Carlos, thanks again.
Arun, always good to be with you. Looking forward to wrapping up 2013.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West.
What was the name of that movie, honey?
In the Heat of the Night.
In the Heat of the Night with Sidney Poitier?
Sidney Poitier is a white man's fantasy of what he wants us to be.
That's from the Lee Daniels film, The Butler, one of a long list of movies that led some to call 2013 a breakout year for black films. Not so fast, says Shawnee Hilton of BuzzFeed.com. I asked her why she thinks we all might want to calm down a little. So I'm going to set this up. You knock it down. 2013 was an amazing year, a watershed moment for black directors and stars. 12 Years a Slave, The Butler, Fruitvale Station, Best Man Holiday, Black Nativity, the list goes on.
Was it? It was a great year for many filmmakers, some of whom were black and some of whom were not black.
But watershed moment?
No, absolutely not. It wasn't a watershed moment. It's kind of an understandable notion to want to talk about that, but some people would argue that by comparing all of these films with each other as opposed to their actual peers in the genres, you're doing them a disservice.
Right, and you actually raised the point, what is a black movie?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you end up seeing these pieces that are written and they say words like race-themed or ethnically diverse films, which doesn't actually tell you anything about the film.
You know, one of the weird things about this discussion that really hit me when I was reading her piece is this feeling of deja vu, right? Like, we had the same discussion when the original Best Man came out in 1999. Before that, there was Boys in the Hood, Do the Right Thing, and going back to the 80s with films like Glory and The Soldier's Story.
Right. When you talk to people who have been in the business for a really long time, they'll tell you, you know, we saw this already 10 years ago. We saw this 20 years ago. We've had all of these fascinating, weird, funny black films. And yet 2013, we're still saying, hey, it's our year. John Ridley, who wrote 12 Years a Slave, he also kind of echoed that when you start to talk about black films, then you end up in a space where you're comparing black films to other black films as opposed to their mates in the same genre.
Right. Say like, you know, the Best Man does really well. And instead of Hollywood thinking that, well, we like romantic comedies that are kind of more from a male point of view, they think we need more black movies.
So Slim, is Jordan your first safari into the enchanted jungle?
He's just messing with you, man.
Best Man Holiday did so well at the box office, it made $30 million in its first weekend, you had Variety saying, this sends a clear message to Hollywood, make more black movies. Right. And that's kind of exactly the problem, is once you make a black movie without thinking about all the things that went into making that film successful, you end up oftentimes with a few flops, and then it becomes harder for people of color, black people or black actors or black directors, to get their own films made.
Well, is there something that really sets 2013 apart for you, or is this kind of a made-up conversation?
I think if something sets 2013 apart, it's kind of the way that distribution models have made it possible for a really wide variety of films, and that includes films that are not by black writers and directors. And so you have places like Affirm, which release black films, and they've released three in the last few years. You have Kickstarter or Indiegogo, the crowdfunding ways. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of times you have, for example, with 12 Years a Slave, that film was developed and produced outside of the studio system with Brad Pitt's Plan B company, and then was picked up for distribution by Fox Searchlight.
I will not fall into despair. I will offer up my talents to Master Ford. I will keep myself hardy till freedom is opportune.
I'm curious. It's been a few weeks since you first wrote this piece. Were people tending to align with your argument?
I found that most people at least understand the point that I'm making. I have seen a few people insist that it's good to celebrate black film as a unit. It kind of comes out of an old-fashioned take on black achievement, which is that we need to celebrate it in any way that we can because nobody else will. And now I think we're at the point where we can say, hey, we should be comparing 12 Years a Slave to other films of its kind, not to Best Man Holiday.
So we're going to be having this conversation again in a few years?
Oh, I hope not.
Shawnee Hilton is the deputy editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed.com. Shawnee, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Until recently, guitarist Ryan Bingham's life had played out like a country song. Long hours on the road, playing small gigs in smoky bars. Then the unthinkable happened. He was discovered and hit the big time. As NPR's Daniel Hajek reports, despite his success, Bingham still sounds at home on the open road.
Ryan Bingham pulls out a rope, lights up a cigarette, and lassos a metal bull in his backyard.
This is a little trick. They call it the butterfly, and it's kind of a basis for a lot of little rope tricks and things like that.
His house is nestled in a canyon that overlooks the Santa Monica mountain range. Out here, you'd never know you were up the road from Los Angeles. Bingham says he feels right at home.
Takes you back to the source of it every now and then.
He's from Hobbs, New Mexico, a little desert town along the border of West Texas.
Out in that part of the world, you had to find ways of entertaining yourself.
This is one of them.
This is one of them, you know. Oh, you sometimes get it to go there.
He says roping brings back memories of the rodeo. Bingham grew up riding bulls.
You're in the middle of their back, and they're spinning and jumping, and then it's just blowing and going, and the dust is flying, and crowds yelling, and it's like driving down the highway 90 miles an hour and throwing the steering wheel out of the window.
I know I never stick around, never lose track of time. We're about a little old town, what I might have left behind.
He and his friends would pile in a truck and travel all over Texas, driving along country highways from one rodeo to another.
Just that experience of being young and out on the road and really free in the wind, and it was absolutely fantastic.
Out of country roads.
Bingham says every chance he got, he'd pack up and head out into the middle of nowhere.
My parents were severe alcoholics, and when I was about 17 years old, I finally left home, and it wasn't really necessarily a choice that I made. Like, it was basically my parents were gone.
So his rodeo buddies became family, and during those long road trips, he kept a guitar in the back seat of his truck, taking it with him whenever they'd stop in at roadhouses and run down bars.
A lot of these little bars we went to were not necessarily places where people went to listen to music. They were places where people went to get drunk and fight.
But Bingham started making a name for himself and eventually wrangled up his own band.
I remember we went to this, it was a bar inside of a motel, and this was like a really, really run-down motel, and they had mice races. And on the marquee, I remember it said out front, it said, Ryan Bingham in Mice Races, you know, Wednesday night. And it was the strangest thing I think I've ever seen in my life, you know. Well, then I'm gonna head down to South Louisiana with a guitar on my back. Cornbread and a gunny sack. Maybe Uncle Sam will cut me some slack. My drummer and I, we had this old Suburban called Blue Thunder. And we just lived out of that Suburban, and pretty much just starving to death. And we'd play coffee shops and diners and hustle up enough gas money to get to the next town. 'Cause I need a little money to
save. Bingham saved up enough money to get to Los Angeles, where he played a little bar near Hollywood. A film agent happened to be in the crowd that night, and after hearing Bingham's set, wanted to help him out.
I had a couple of homemade demo CDs with some songs on it, and he just started handing them out to people he knew. And he was the guy that sent my music to Scott Cooper,
the actor and director.
I listened to that music, and I said to myself, my God, this guy has an incredible voice. I said, sounds like Ryan might be the perfect guy.
The perfect guy to make a song for Cooper's new film called Crazy Heart, the story of Bad Blake, an aging songwriter fading from country music.
What's your real name?
In this scene, Gene Craddock, a reporter played by Maggie Gyllenhaal, interviews Jeff Bridges as Bad Blake.
I'm Bad Blake. Wasn't born bad. When I die, my tombstone will have my real name on it. Until then, I'm just gonna stay bad.
It's an awful long time for people to have to wait to find out.
Maybe, maybe not.
Cooper asked Bingham if he'd be interested in writing something.
And I think at that time, Ryan maybe was living in his truck. I give him the script, and he goes off. And the next day, he calls me, and he says, I think I have something that might interest you.
Cooper invited him over to meet T-Bone Burnett, the Grammy Award-winning record producer. He told him to bring his guitar.
He said, come on in. He said, "Let's, you know, show us what you got."
So he picked up his guitar and began to strum his song.
It immediately finds a place in your soul. And that was just with Ryan strumming the intro. And then once he started singing, his voice is so rich and whiskey-soaked that you can't even believe it's coming out of this young guy. T-Bone was just shaking his head, and he was like, geez, that's incredible.
Your heart's on the loose. You rolled them sevens with nothing to lose. This ain't no place for the weary kind.
That song, titled The Weary Kind, became the theme from Crazy Heart. And that year, it was nominated for Best Original Song at the 2009 Academy Awards.
And the winners are Ryan Bingham and T-Bone Burnett, The Weary Kind and Crazy Heart.
No place to fall behind. Up your crazy heart and give it one more try.
Suddenly, Bingham was traveling across the country on press tours and interviews, selling out venues and playing on late-night TV shows. But while he was in the spotlight, he was dealing with a tragedy in his own life.
At the start of it, my father had committed suicide. And so even though everything was such a wonderful time and I felt really honored about it, there was still something very big in my life that was going on that was very hard not to think about. It was probably one of the best and worst times of my whole life, you know.
This ain't no place for the weary kind.
His Oscar isn't in a glass case or anywhere on display. It just stands on the floor in the corner of his bedroom.
It's still as heavy as it was when I first held it. Brings back a, you know, a lot of feelings, that's for sure. It's still kind of hard for me to wrap my head around a lot of that, how, you know, all that stuff that happened. It's still pretty surreal to me. And it seems like I've always kind of been waiting for it to kind of sit in, but it never really has.
Since his Oscar, he's released two albums. He'll start recording a new one next month. And on Monday, he'll join Willie Nelson on stage at Austin City Limits. Ryan Bingham's days of riding bulls and living in his truck may be part of his past, but this 32-year-old songwriter still has a lot to sing about.
Yeah, you know, there's some things that you can't muscle your way through some things in life. Some things you just have to Keep your head on your shoulders, and you just got to dance with it as you go.
Daniel Hajek, NPR News.
You're falling fast. You're a rock hitting glass. Running from your shattered past.
Finally, as the year ends, we want to bid a very fond farewell to someone who's been an indispensable support to this program, Key Molesky. Key is our reference librarian. I don't want to sound like a fogey, but ever since Google became a verb, I don't think most people appreciate the power of a skilled librarian. In fact, an easy way to understand is to try to imagine finding out anything without an internet search. If the web went down right now, librarians would be just about the only people who would know how to find out anything. And believe it or not, Google searches just don't cover everything. That's why a real librarian, someone who knows how to find real facts, is so valuable. That's one of the reasons you hear stories and reporting on NPR you can't find anywhere else, why you're listening to me and not just getting all your news from your computer. During the years I was away from NPR, there was a lot I missed about this place. But what I missed most, and most often, were the reference librarians. I can't begin to tell you what it means to a journalist to be able to pick up the phone and call someone like Key. She's made us sound better and smarter. There is one positive aspect to this for us, but it's a very petty one. From now on, whenever I make a mistake, mispronounce something, anything like that, I've got an easy dodge. It's because Key Molesky is gone. For the week ending December 29th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, and Daniel Hajek. The technical director is Patrick Murray. We had engineering support from Leah Delagula and Theo Mondel. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories featured on All Things Considered on Saturday and Sunday. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening, and Happy New Year.